One of the most interesting things about science is that it can be used by just about anybody to establish that black is white, or at least that it black might be white. The fact that science by itself cannot prove everything beyond any doubt has led to some very interesting debates and some very interesting patterns of behaviour. Researcher Naomi Oreskes has spent the last few years tracing the ways in which science has been used as a political football to blunt assertions such as smoking is seriously harmful to your health. She discovered that the same scientists who decades ago were saying smoking may not cause you harm have turned up consistently arguing the case against ozone depletion and more recently against the general consensus on climate change. Funny that, she thought. I spoke to her about it.
You say that doubt works, and it works in part because we have an erroneous view of science. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we mean by that is that most people think that science gives us proof. They think of science as something that has definite answers. We have an image of science based on our schooling, where we maybe took a chemistry class and you could look up the answer in the back of the book. So we think that science should have an answer that you could put in the back of the book and that everyone would agree on. But the reality is that scientific research, active scientific work, is much, much more complicated than that. And in particular, when we look at natural systems like the Earth's climate system, the climate system is very complex. It involves many different feedbacks, and our descriptions of them are always necessarily somewhat incomplete. So there are always things that we don't fully understand. There are always uncertainties. And it's that uncertainty, that natural uncertainty in all live, active scientific research, that the merchants of doubt took out of context, exploited, and even to this day continue to exploit to try to claim that we don't know enough to act.
Yes, my science as good as your science. Yes.
Yeah, exactly, right.
You lay out a whole lot of evidence here about the fact that the same people keep popping up, casting
right.
doubt. Those who cast doubt on the science of the health effects of tobacco appear to have transmogrified into climate change doubters. Who are these people?
Well, the story we tell in the book, we tell the story of three men in particular who created a think tank in 1984 called the George C. Marshall Institute. And originally they created that institute to defend Ronald Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative, or what most of us know of as Star Wars. So these were people with a very strongly anti-communist ideology, and they had worked throughout most of their career in American Cold War weapons and rocketry programs. So initially they came together to defend strategic defense, but one of them, Frederick Seitz, was also working for the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, where he directed a biomedical research program whose purpose was to support distracting research, to support research that could confuse the issue, muddy the waters about the scientific evidence of the harms of tobacco, and also to cultivate scientists who could appear as experts in litigation to say, well, we didn't really know for sure, it wasn't proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And what we show in the book, and really the reason we wrote the book when we made this discovery, was the really shocking discovery that these same people then became climate change deniers and also challenged the scientific evidence of the severity of acid rain and the reality of the ozone hole. So what we discovered, that there was a pattern, that these guys were like serial contrarians. And that was, for us, the giveaway, that this wasn't a genuine scientific debate, because no scientist could be an expert on global warming and the ozone hole and acid rain and DDT and secondhand smoke. I mean, that's just not credible. Nobody's that smart. So when we saw that they were engaged in this whole range of different activities that had begun with the defense of tobacco, then we realized that something else was going on.
Have these people ever denied the fact that they've effectively tried to stymie what is an advance in scientific findings?
You mean, in effect, denying that they're deniers? Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And this continues to this day. So the three main figures in the book who we begin the story with, they're all deceased now. They were already quite elderly when they turned into this sort of denial machine. And they're now dead. But other people, of course, have taken up the charge, the work, and they continue it to this day. And the Marshall Institute still exists. And it's very interesting because they still continue to do this uncertainty mongering. So just the other day, the ABC ran a small bit of them responding to my work in which they said, well, you know, there's still an awful lot of uncertainty about climate science. So even today, they're continuing this doubt mongering. But of course, they don't admit that it's doubt-mongering. They would say that it's principled, that they want to ensure that science is based on good public policy. But I think the connection to the tobacco industry really gives lie to that claim because, I mean, nobody would say that good public policy is based on what the tobacco industry has to say about tobacco.
This is endemic, though, isn't it, in when there are commercial interests involved and those interests combine with science, they create their own scientific establishments, they hire their own scientists. There's nothing particularly unusual about that. Is it getting worse?
Well, yes, I think it is getting worse. And part of what we were trying to show in the book was this pattern. So although you say there's nothing particularly unusual about it, my experience, my lecturing shows that a lot of people are not really fully aware of this. I mean, maybe a lot of people kind of have an inkling, a little bit of a clue, you know, people sort of notice, people know what the tobacco industry did, they sort of notice that there's some similar things going on in other places. But I think a lot of people haven't really appreciated the pattern, the extensive nature of it. I mean, I would say I didn't appreciate it before I wrote this book. The really extensive nature of it, how far back it goes, how well organized it is, and how extensive, and how it continues today with a whole new crop of climate deniers, with a new crop of think tanks and a new crop of sponsors.
How dependent was the tobacco industry in the 60s and 70s on this science?
Well, I would say they were extremely dependent because when the strong scientific evidence began to coalesce on the harms of tobacco in the 1950s, the tobacco industry was frankly panicked, and there are many, many documents that attest to this. And it was that panic that led them to hire a public relations firm, the American firm of Hill and Knowlton, to give them advice about how to respond. And many people at that time thought quite seriously that the United States government would outlaw tobacco, that they would ban it entirely, and that there would be a new round of prohibition. And indeed, in the 1960s, when evidence began to come forward that nicotine was an addictive drug, the tobacco industry suppressed that evidence because they feared that if people understood that the tobacco, that nicotine was in fact a drug, that it was an addictive drug like opium or morphine or heroin, that the government would have almost no choice but to make it a controlled substance like heroin. So it was a very crucial part of their strategy to suppress the evidence of the addictive quality of nicotine and to monger doubt around all of the other harms. And that strategy was extremely successful because although the United States and other countries took steps to control tobacco advertising or to make warnings, we never did ban tobacco completely, and it was not until last year, 2009, so more than 50 years later, that the U.S. Congress finally gave the Food and Drug Authority the legal authority to control tobacco as a regulated drug.
That's nearly 50 years after the Surgeon General had declared it unequivocally the cause of lung cancer.
Exactly. So half a century of delay. And during that half a century, the tobacco industry did two things. First of all, continued to make billions of dollars in profits and also developed a marketing strategy to market tobacco outside the United States in China and other parts of Southeast Asia. So today, even though smoking rates are greatly reduced in the United States, Europe, Canada, Australia, smoking continues to be very, very extensive in China and other places. So the tobacco industry had a lot of time to reorganize their marketing strategies and to stay highly profitable as an industry overall, even though they lost customers in the United States.
There were some very great names. You've mentioned Fred Seitz, Fred Singer as well. These
yes.
were frontline scientists, enormously respected. And
exactly.
I guess because of the sheer punching power of those people publicly, the tobacco industry was able to use them. But how much did it use them up front?
Well, in the beginning of the story, these people are quite up front, they're quite public, and it's part of the strategy. The tobacco industry understands that the more distinguished the scientists are, the more effective and credible they'll be. And an important part of the strategy also was to use the media, to pressure the media to give equal time to their story. And so having scientists who were highly distinguished, highly credible, was really crucial to that. Now, one of the ironies of the story, as time goes on, we see that the, let's just say, the quality of the scientists involved in the story declines over time, so that by the later part of the story, by today, we see that the kinds of people who are involved in denying the evidence of climate change are actually much, much less distinguished, much less significant scientists than the people who began this story. And yet, because this pattern has been established, we see the press continuing to give tremendous amounts of airtime. We see the ABC calling for equal time for these people, even though they're not distinguished scientists, in many cases, they're not even climate scientists. And even if they were climate scientists, and even if they were distinguished, this is a tiny, tiny, tiny handful of people compared to the thousands of scientists who have worked on global warming and accumulated massive amounts of evidence about the changes that are taking place in the Earth's climate today.
You suggest fairly trenchantly that in the book that it's unwise to reject the consensus of experts that certainly has emerged in terms of climate change. Particularly if the dissenter is superannuated, disgruntled, a habitual contrarian, or in the pay of a group with an obvious ideological agenda, or vested political or economic interests, or in some cases all of the above. Was any of those great scientists all of the above?
Well, I don't know if any one of them was all of the above, but I think certainly there are some people who have been active in these denial campaigns who were, and this is one of the things that just never ceases to amaze me, that the press, including distinguished newspapers and, you know, places like the ABC here in Australia, you know, would give so much time, so much airspace, and so much credibility to people who are, you know, disgruntled, superannuated, or in the pay of a group with an obvious vested interest. I mean, this is the pattern now, and it is very shocking to me. And it's particularly shocking that some people in the press would take the work of, say, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, as I just mentioned, represents the work of thousands of scientists from over 100 countries worldwide, scientists of very diverse political orientation, men, women, blacks, whites, you know, very diverse, very hardworking scientists. And then juxtapose that against, well, let's just say, for example, one geologist in Queensland.
Yes. I'm interested in the role of Hill & Knowlton here, respectable Madison Avenue PR firm, appears to have done the dirty work up front. Were there any qualms about that? Were they happy to promote what they call distracting research, or did they just get straight in and do it?
Well, distracting research is our term. They, of course, don't okay. call it that. But that's our argument, is that a sense, because some of the research they funded was legitimate scientific research, particularly in the early days, but the point was to distract attention. So you would do research on some other cause of cancer apart from tobacco, and then you would say, look, a lot of lung cancer is caused by radon. And, of course, that was true, and so it was a very clever strategy because they weren't lying. Some lung cancers are caused by radon, but that doesn't mean that tobacco is safe. Now, were they troubled by that? I don't really know. We didn't do research on the history of the PR industry, but it is interesting that one of our good colleagues, James Hogan, who has written a kind of complimentary book called Climate Cover-Up, is himself a leading PR man in Canada. And one of the reasons Jim wrote his book was because he was so outraged by what his industry had done, because his view is that good PR helps companies speak to their clients and, you know, convey a message about the work that they do, and that good PR shouldn't be about lying and misrepresenting scientific work.
Do you think that we would be in a situation today where companies like Philip Morris and British American Tobacco are still contesting various aspects of what you can do by way of promoting cigarettes, taking on the government of Uruguay, for instance, where there's a global anti-smoking treaty being drafted up? Do you think we would be at this, still at this lingering stage of rearguard action by the tobacco industry if it hadn't been for the reputations and the efforts of those scientists?
Oh, well, that's a very good question. Well, it's hard to know, of course, since that's a counterfactual. But certainly the fact that there were distinguished scientists who were willing to work with the tobacco industry and lend their names, their reputations, their credibility to this campaign certainly emboldened the tobacco industry. I mean, I think it is fair to say that if all scientists had stood up and said, no, we won't do this, we won't grace the tobacco industry with this credibility of our scientific reputations, the tobacco industry would have been pulled up short, and I think the history would most likely have been different.
When it came to the whole question of nuclear winter and the nuclear deterrent systems, Star Wars, as you've described before, they began to attack the messengers, didn't they? The relationship between these people and Carl Sagan, for instance, who claimed that nuclear winter meant it was basically all up for humanity. Was this a technique that was used often, and is it still used?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked about that chapter in the book, because most journalists don't actually ask us about that chapter, and I think a lot of people just skip over the chapter.
I found it the most interesting one.
But it's actually really crucial, because it speaks to the political ideology that drives the whole campaign, and it also shows how the campaign spread and turned and got worse, got more unprincipled as they began to attack scientists. So you mentioned Carl Sagan, and Carl Sagan was involved with a group of scientists who did scientific research that showed, and let me backtrack for a minute. So this is back in the 1980s when the Reagan administration in the United States is pushing Star Wars and also pushing the idea of a limited nuclear engagement and arguing that it could be possible to have a limited nuclear engagement, which would be that the United States could win, so a winnable nuclear war. And, of course, this was a huge departure from the policies of all previous American presidents, going back to Harry Truman, who had acknowledged that nobody wins a nuclear war and that the key to the Cold War would be to maintain the peace through the balance of terror and mutual assured destruction. So Ronald Reagan departed from that and started talking about limited nuclear war. And, of course, that was extremely alarming to many people. So a group of scientists took that on as a scientific question, and they said, well, what would happen if we had a limited exchange of just a small portion of the nuclear arsenal just between the United States and the Soviet Union? And what they showed was that if that happened, there would be a high likelihood that the amount of dust and soot in the atmosphere from this exchange would so darken the globe that we would be thrust into a nuclear winter and many of us would perish from starvation. Now, we take this example is extremely interesting because it's an example of science working as it should and yet nevertheless being attacked by the deniers. So what happens then after the nuclear winter article is published, a number of scientists take issue with it and they say, well, they're not sure about all the assumptions in the model. Let's look more closely at it. And they do look more closely. And in the end, they discover, well, nuclear winter might actually be a little bit exaggerated. It would be rather better to call it nuclear autumn, that there would be a significant cooling, that it probably would have serious impacts on crops, but it might not be quite as devastating as had been put forward in the original proposal. And so that was science working as it should, a hypothesis being put forward, work being done to test the hypothesis, and then the hypothesis being adjusted in light of new information. But what we see happening in the story is that the merchants of doubt don't accept that. And they don't say, oh, all right, so this is still serious, even if perhaps not quite as catastrophic as we initially thought. They launch a full-fledged attack on the science, the scientist, Carl Sagan. They hire another person, Russell Seitz, who's a cousin of Frederick Seitz, to write an article in which he attacks science in general. He attacks the scientific method. And meanwhile, he's also defending cigarettes. So, you know, it's a beautiful case where we see the whole thing in a way starting to unravel and become really unprincipled and really quite hysterical in a certain kind of way. And that's one of the other ironies of the story, that contrarians always like to accuse environmentalists of being hysterical, and yet we see a kind of anti-paranoid hysteria, a kind of anti-communist paranoid hysteria in their own work on strategic defense and nuclear winter.
I suppose Ben Santa, the climate modeler who got attacked, could hardly be described as hysterical.
Well, exactly.
And I guess this was an example of the same process, the same technique at work.
Exactly. And so then we show in the book a series of examples where similar things happen. So then in 1995, when the second assessment report of the IPCC comes out, so it's the second report, but it's the first substantial report, and it's a crucial report because it's the first place where scientists say, yes, global warming is underway. The human fingerprint on the climate system is discernible. That's the word they use, discernible. And it's crucial because A, they're saying climate change is actually already happening, and B, they're saying, yes, we have the scientific evidence to say this is caused by human activities. It's not caused by the sun or volcanoes or other natural variability. Ben Santer was the lead author on the key chapter of that report, the chapter called Detection and Attribution, which is the chapter in which the scientists explain how do we detect global warming and how do we know, how do we attribute it to human causes rather than other potential causes. So it's a really crucial piece of scientific work. And the Nuremberg sites, and now a third scientist, a fourth scientist, Fred Singer, launch an all-out attack on the lead author of that chapter, Ben Santer. And it's an extremely unprincipled attack. They accuse him of falsifying documents. They accuse him of changing the report without permission. They send letters to his employer trying to get him fired from his job. They write pieces attacking him by name in the Wall Street Journal. So it's really unbelievable, and none of it is true. There's no evidence that's ever put forward that any of the accusations against Ben were correct.
And no apologies. I wanted to ask you finally about the role of the media in all this. You raise this. You say there's a problem here of the he said, she said variety. Equal time needs to be given. What is the media's responsibility now, given the fact that the overwhelming weight of evidence seems to be in favour of the fact that anthropogenic impacts are changing the climate?
Well, I think the media's responsibility is to report the facts, to report things accurately, and balance is not necessarily accurate. So if you have a situation where 99% of all scientists agree that the evidence is overwhelming in support of a proposition like tobacco causing cancer or greenhouse gases warming the planet, and you have one or two people who dissent, well, there's always dissent in science, and that's a good thing. I mean, science is an open process. People do have the right to have other opinions, and scientists do not suppress disagreement and dissent. So it's perfectly fine that those people exist and have their views. But what's not fine is to give them equal time or nearly equal time in an article, which then leaves the public with the impression that there's a raging scientific debate. So the press, by following this idea of equal time and balance, have actually reported the state of scientific knowledge inaccurately and really done a profound disservice to the public who read these materials and become very confused and don't know what to think.
Yes, that's Naomi Oreskes. Her book, Merchants of Doubt, written with Eric M. Conway, is published by Allen and Unwin.